This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is singer-songwriter and guitarist John Phillips, who founded the pop group The Mamas and the Papas and wrote most of their songs. While they were together from 1964 to 69, the Mamas and Papas' hit songs included Monday, Monday, Go Where You Wanna Go, Trip, Stumble, and Fall, I Saw Her Again Last Night, and California Dreamin'. The Mamas and Papas became media symbols of the hippie counterculture. Phillips also co-produced the Monterey Pop Festival, which was the first major outdoor rock festival and became a landmark of the 60s. Phillips' life as a pop star was a far cry from his boyhood in Catholic military boarding schools. In his early music career, Phillips led several folk groups, including the Journeymen, whose harmonies were inspired by vocal groups like the Four Lads and the Hi-Los. By the mid-60s, the Beatles were Phillips' main vocal inspiration. In the 70s, after the Mamas and Papas broke up, Phillips struck out on his own, but without any commercial success. He developed heroin and cocaine habits that nearly killed him. In 1980, he was arrested on drug charges and went into therapy. He served 30 days with 5 years probation, which ended in May 1986. When Phillips was in drug therapy, so were his third wife, Genevieve Waite, and his two children from his first marriage, Jeffrey and Mackenzie. When he was well enough to work again, Phillips revived the Mamas and Papas with Denny Doherty and two new members, including his daughter, actress Mackenzie Phillips. John Phillips has chronicled his life in his new book, Papa John, published by Doubleday. I asked him about the original Mamas and Papas, which included his second wife, Michelle Phillips, Denny Doherty, and Cass Elliot. He told me how Cass Elliot joined.
We were in the Virgin Islands, and Michelle and Denny and I were singing on stage. As the journeyman, the new journeyman, and Cass was waiting tables in this restaurant and trying to convince us that she could sing with us, you know. A wonderful singer like Cass, you know, waiting the tables, and we're up there singing, and she's trying to convince us to let her join the group, and we're saying, no, your range is too low. They were doing some construction work there, and a workman happened to drop a 6-inch lead pipe, and it landed on Cass's head from 30 feet up, and they gave her a concussion, and she went to the hospital for a couple of days, and she came back, and for some reason, she was able to sing a tone and a half, 2 tones higher than she had when she went in the hospital. And from then on, her voice fitted in perfectly into the harmonies.
You write in your book about how surprised you were the first time you saw her, because she was so big. Did you ever go through this thing of thinking, how would she look on stage, and would it be bad for the group's image to have someone who was really fat in the group?
No, that never occurred to me, but it sure occurred to Cass. I mean, Cass said she would never go on stage on the same stage as Michelle, because Michelle was so slim and so pretty, and Cass felt that she looked awful next to Michelle, but she looked all right with a couple of guys around her, but not anywhere near Michelle. And it took us a long time to convince Cass to go on stage and to perform live with Michelle as her singing partner. But the first time she did it, and she realized that Michelle had beauty and all this, but that Cass really had the warmth and the personality and could just grab the audience with her vocal ability, things that Michelle couldn't do. From then on, Cass was like, hey, what's the big problem here, you know? Get this little thing out of here. I'll take care of everything.
Michelle, who you referred to, was your second wife, and you met her just to fill everybody in when you were about 26 or something.
Yeah, I was about 26, and she was about 16.
And you married her. You left your first wife for her, and
yeah.
And ended up performing together, even though she didn't initially plan on going into music. Why did you decide to include her in the group? Because she hadn't been a performer.
No, as a matter of fact, she'd grown up in Mexico, and she'd never sung professionally at all. But we would go on these long road trips with the journeymen, and she would always travel with us. And we would sing in the car. And as this went on for like 3 years, you know, being on the road, and she just got better and better and better. And she had a real street sense of rock and roll. She had a better street sense of rock and roll than Cass had. Cass had incredible technique and tone and all these things. Michelle really had that sort of Phil Spector kind of, you know, the Ronettes kind of, you know, or the Shangri-Las or something like that. You know, she would have fit right into that group perfectly. So it was a nice balance of technique and raw talent between the two of them.
What was your concept for the group in terms of the production of the record and the vocal harmonies that you were working?
Well, my influences were these other groups who had been so extremely musical, and I'd always liked the sound of men and women singing together. So I wanted to, have a group that was two guys and two girls, and that would have featured soloists and a lot of answer back harmonies and things like that, you know. And Lou Adler was very responsible for taking what I did with just one guitar and vocal arrangements. I mean, we could sing anything live, you know, because everyone knew how to sing and all that. But he found, like, the best musicians on the West Coast and put them behind us, like really good rock musicians like Hal Blaine and Larry Nechtel and Joe Osborne and people like that. And the mixture of those things, once again, it was like, you know, that's where Lou's genius as a producer really lies, in finding someone who can really write good songs, someone who can really sing well, and then get a great band and put it all together. And that's what a producer should do, you know.
Some producers who see the potential in a band then dress them up in all kinds of arrangements that they don't fit into.
Yeah.
Did you have to fight for that at all? He had a good sense of what would be good for you?
Yeah, he just left us alone. He's, you know, as a matter of fact, like California Dreaming was originally done as a track for Barry McGuire. And when Lou heard the song, he thought that would be a great follow-up for Barry for Eve of Destruction.
I can't see that, actually.
Well, it didn't work out. But that original track and the original background vocals were cut for a Barry McGuire album, and then it's on Barry's album, as a matter of fact, with the Mamas and Papas singing all the backgrounds on that album, but it just didn't sound right. And then Lou said himself, "Well, why don't you let we'll have Denny sing it also, you know." And Denny sings an octave higher than Barry, and he put Denny on it, and all of a sudden it went boom into this beautiful sound. And that's how California Dreaming was actually made. It was made for Barry McGuire.
But then it was remade for...
It wasn't remade. I mean, we put the lead on top of the track we did for Barry.
Oh, so it's just right on top of that?
Yeah.
That's really amazing.
It took Barry's voice off and put Denny's on, and that was it.
Well, as soon as the Mamas and Papas signed a 5-year contract, which wedded them together for 5 years, things started to break apart in the group a little bit. It was right after you signed the contract, right, that you found out your lover, Michelle, was actually sleeping with Denny from the group.
Yeah.
That must have been really devastating.
It was, yeah. It was very hard. It wasn't just my lover, Michelle. It was my wife, Michelle, by that point.
Yeah. Even
We'd
worse.
We'd gone past that point, yeah. It was Denny's lover, my wife. What it really was. It was sort of devastating, you know, and Cass was, you know, deeply in love with Denny, and Denny loved Cass as a brother and sister sort of thing, you know, and gosh, I don't know, it seems like we just had to leave everything outside the studio, you know, and when we got into the studio, just make the music, and that was the only thing that eased the tension, was working continually.
You know what's funny to me? You're listening to these records, you say, wow, I bet this group has such a good time together.
We did.
Did you?
Yeah, but in sort of an unconventional way.
Because I'm thinking, like, gosh, you know, you just never know if people are at each other's throats or carrying on behind each other's backs and stuff. And you always think, oh, it just must be great to tour together and so on. And
well, you know, we all lived in the same house for years. And, you know, it was like a communal lifestyle, and it was sort of one of the first LSD communes, you know, that sprang up all over the country. You know, we had our own little commune of four people, and I think we did everything that 30 people could have done had they been there, you know. Every combination came forth.
You threw Michelle out of the group for a while. Can you explain the circumstances behind that?
Well, I prefer to think of it as
yeah,
as, you know, when Michelle, you know, there was, of course, there was a group called the Byrds, and a very good songwriter and guitar player and singer who's a very good friend of mine now also, named Gene Clark, in the group. And Michelle and I had broken up for the umpteenth time, and she was dating Gene, and we were playing at a place called Melody Land out in California. And Simon and Garfunkel were the opening act for us, and it was a big show that night. And Gene was sitting in the front row, and Michelle was playing to Gene, and I really got angry, and I felt very hurt, and I could not overcome my jealousy through mental training. So I just went to Cass and Denny, and I said, "Yeah, I just can't do this anymore. I can't really work under these circumstances." I said, "You know, either Michelle has to go or I have to go." I said, "I'm very willing to go out and form a new group or do anything, you know, but one of us has got to get out of here because it's driving me nuts, and I just can't do it." And so they said, "Well, throw her out. Let's get rid of her then." And so we went to the record company, and Lou said, "Well, whatever you guys want to do, you know." And so in Michelle's book, which is out right now, called California Dreamin', she has a picture of the letter, you know, which is signed by everyone, not just by me, Terry. I couldn't keep her out of the group for long anyway, because I was so in love with her. It didn't make much difference, you know. She was out for, oh, I guess 3 or 4 months tops, I suppose.
Well, I think it's in your book, or maybe it's in her book. There's a photograph of Jill, who was the woman who came in to replace
Jill Gibson, yeah.
Yeah, of her superimposed in the place of the Mamas and Papas photo where Michelle used to be. And
They looked very similar. They looked very much alike to start with.
But it troubled me, though, that whoever was doing publicity or whatever,
yeah,
would take this photograph and wipe out Michelle and just plunk somebody else in that spot.
Troubled you, did it?
Yeah.
Think how Michelle felt.
Yeah, I can imagine how she felt.
She slugged Denny.
Really?
Yeah, walked into the studio and slugged him, knocked him over the piano. Of course, Michelle has slugged quite a few people. Yeah, she slugged me a lot of times, too.
And vice versa.
And vice versa. Right. Yeah, we used to have real brawls, knockdown waterfront fights, you know.
Well, you became big stars and were able to fulfill whatever material fantasies you had. What did you want, you know, as far as that money could buy? What did you want to bring into your life?
It turned out there was nothing that money could buy that we really wanted.
Really?
That was the sad part of the whole thing.
You mean it would?
We made all this money. On the last album, there's a song called Mansions that I wrote, you know, which says that why isn't this like the dream? You know, we made everything came true that we said we were set out to get. We got our Grammy, we got this, we had our mansion, we had, you know, celebrity status, we had a lot of money, we had Rolls Royces, you know.
You had five of them, right?
Yeah, and no one was happy at all. You know, we were much happier when we were bumming around the islands with no money at all, but still singing the same songs, you know, with the same group of people.
So what did you do? I mean, did you want to sell the stuff? What happens once you get into that? You've been able to buy everything you wanted, then you realize it's not as good as you thought it was going to be. Does that mean you want to sell it or be broke again?
You really lose respect for it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, the material thing, that you really lose a lot of respect for it. And I think that was one of the reasons why when I got into drugs, I was able to immediately dispose of all material possessions and turn them into drugs.
Right, right.
And which were disposable also.
What were some of the reasons why you broke up?
Well, there were a couple of reasons. One was the underlying effect of all the different affairs the group members had had with each other and things like that. And the difficulty of men and women living in close quarters, caged animals, you know, sex rearing its ugly head and things like that. And another reason was that we just could not keep up the creativity. We were burned out emotionally. From all the tension we had created for ourselves, and we were burned out on LSD, and we were burned out artistically. We had just worked so hard in that 3-year period in the studio, just day after day after day, 18-hour days, under the influence of drugs, and just on and on and on and on, laying on layer after layer of music and voices and new songs and new harmonies and new arrangements. We started to do a fifth album, and we just couldn't match what we had already done at all, couldn't come close to it. And we realized that if we kept the Mamas and Papas going from then on, it was just going to be a downhill thing.
And you didn't want that to happen.
And we
so
started
you split.
Calling it Downhill Records instead of Dunhill Records. And the writing was on the wall, you know. We said, let's just leave this alone. This was very good, these four albums. Let's not play with it, all right? We'll just go home now.
It seems like you were all starting to go a little berserk at around that time,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, well, you know, when you take that much acid in that short amount of time, you know, we didn't really, we thought everyone was sort of taking it. We didn't know that we were sort of like out there on the cutting edge of, you know, psychedelia. We had no idea, really. We went to a fellow named Dr. Cohn, in Los Angeles at UCLA, Dennis and I, and because we were like, our nervous systems were like, you know, our hands were shaking and we couldn't eat and things, you know, we were dropping forks and things like that, you know. And he was like, you know, in charge of nervous disorders at UCLA, and he said, well, why are you guys this way? Well, I mean, what, tell me about an average day for you. Well, we get up, we take our acid, we said, you do what? You know, we take our acid, and he says, what do you take acid every day? So, well, not every day, but, you know, like four or five times a week at least, you know. He says, well, how long have you been doing this? I said, well, for 2.5, 3 years. He said, oh, my God, you're lucky you're alive. And then he took us on a tour of his psychiatric ward, and he showed us so many real burnouts, people who did have bad trips and bad experiences who never came back. And he said, that's what you guys really should be, is in there. He said, after what you've done to yourselves, you've got to stop this right now.
Did you stop?
Not immediately, no. We did cut down to once a week, though.
My guest is John Phillips, and he's written an autobiography called Papa John. After the Mamas and Papas disbanded, you went through a period of trying to do a Broadway show, of doing, I think, one or two independent records by yourself. But none of that stuff was very commercially successful.
Not at all.
But also around that period in the 1970s, that's when you started shooting up and really getting into hard drugs. What led to that? And I ask that knowing that you'd already seen friends of yours OD on drugs, so you weren't naive about
I wasn't at all naive about
And you'd seen
it.
What had happened to you from taking all the acid.
Yeah. I don't think that's ever a deterrent, that a friend of yours, I mean, a lot of friends of mine had seen a lot of their friends die from drugs, and then they died from drugs. And why I didn't die from drugs, I'll never know. Just luck of the draw, I guess. But I had a string of things that didn't really satisfy me, and starting with the Wolf King album, which I never really... I loved the songs I'd written for it, but I didn't like the way I sang on it. I thought it was, you know, I was very depressed. I'd broken up with Michelle again, of course. And I had just started living with Genevieve Waite, the girl I eventually married. And then I got a chance to go to London to do the film score and then to sing the score for The Man Who Fell to Earth, David Bowie film. And I went to London and I ran into Keith Richard again. And we started living together, and he helped me work on the score, as did Mick Taylor. And Jagger and Richards and I have been friends for years and years and years by that time, you know, 10 years anyway. And Keith was very heavily into heroin at that time. And when we started living together, there was always heroin around the house. And I had become just callous toward drug use because I'd been doing it for so many years. And it just to watch Keith, you know, Keith somehow was able to maintain on it, you know, and just sort of still do his work and play his music and so forth. And so I started experimenting with it, and so did Genevieve. And next thing I knew, I was addicted to it.
How did you know when you were actually addicted?
My nose started running. You know, I had, my eyes started getting red, and I was feeling clammy in the morning and things like that. And I thought I was getting the flu. And Keith said, no, what you need to fix, you know. And at that moment, I had a decision to make. You know, there was some heroin on the table, and there was a whole world outside, and I took the heroin. And it took me a long time to get over it.
Did it ever get to the point where, like, your sources, you had enough money, at least at the beginning, to buy from people who wouldn't necessarily give you a lot of trouble? You didn't have to go on the streets to buy. But did it ever get to the point where you had to go to, like, shooting galleries and you know, like, really awful street places to get drugs?
Well, not really until, I guess, 1980. I mean, I had a drugstore in New York City that... I had an arrangement with the pharmacist there to get all pharmaceutical drugs, pharmaceutical cocaine, pharmaceutical morphine, Dilaudids, Dioxins. And it was like a drug supermarket for me. And so I would just go in there with a shopping bag once a week and take all the drugs off the shelves and pay them twice the retail value and walk off with them. And then we'd all just pass them around. You know? And then when the DEA closed that drugstore down, that's when I did hit the streets and tried to clean up and had that incredible 4th of July weekend I just referred to in the book when Mick and Jerry Hall came out to visit us in the Hamptons for the weekend. And I tried to burn the house down and we were going through violent withdrawal and wrecked my car and Mick took my kids away from me, wouldn't give them back because I was so crazed at the time. And he was absolutely right, as it turned out. He had warned me before in London, you know. He said, gee, you know, you're doing too much of this stuff. Don't you think you're doing, you know, here's the master of understatement, you know. And I was cooking up some heroin in the kitchen of my house and about to inject it. And Mick said, don't you think you're doing a bit much of that, you know. I said, no, I can handle it, no problem. He said, oh, okay. And he walked in, that's all he ever really said about it. But I could feel him sort of withdraw a bit from me, bit by bit at that time.
If you weren't busted and if you didn't enter a therapy program because of that, do you think you would have stopped on your own?
No. I tried a lot. I tried many times, and I wasn't able to do it. And I never tried it, you know, in a therapeutic situation, in an actual hospital or rehab with intensive psychiatry and group therapy and things like that. And I don't think that it's a possible thing to do, you know, to kick a hardcore heroin habit by yourself. I've never known anyone to do it yet. And anybody who's interested in a bit of advice, if you have a drug problem, first thing you have to do is identify it, you know, and say, I have a drug problem. And then you have to check in somewhere and get some help. And then comes the real long withdrawal. And it's not just the physical withdrawal, it's the psychological withdrawal that's so difficult.
Yeah, for you, you had started with drugs, for, you know, smoking grass and then doing a lot of psychedelics. And then you were pretty mature by the time you started shooting. You were in your 30s, right?
No, I was
you were in your 40s?
When I started, I was 40 years old, yeah.
You must have been really upset, though, when you found out that your two oldest children were starting to do hard drugs when they were in their teens.
Yeah, well, and a lot of that was, you know, because of me, because that was the way they were trying to get my attention, you know, because I was so involved in drug use. For instance, I don't think Mackenzie ever would have developed any kind of a drug habit anywhere near. I'm sure she would have experimented with drugs like most, you know, kids do. But I think, you know, she's always been a sensible kid, and she would have pulled back and kept on with her career, and she had a great career going. But her need to communicate with her father was the only way she could find to do it was, you know, through drugs.
When you were on probation, did they monitor you constantly to check your body fluids and see if you were doing any drugs?
I've been looking for a term like that.
What, body fluids?
Yes.
sum it all up in one term.
Right. Yes, they did. They did all the time. And as a matter of body fluids, I won't forget that. Would you put some of your body fluids in this jar, please? I constantly gave them body fluids. I had a very, you know, I had an easier time than most people. Like when I went into the rehab, I was 45 years old. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was the oldest guy. And I mean, most of the people were 19 years old or 20 years old. Here I was 45, you know, in group therapy with people who were old enough, you know, to be my grandchildren almost, you know. It was a bizarre situation. Plus, you know, my daughter and my son were there, and my wife was there, and the whole family was in hospital at the same time. So I was monitored very heavily during probation. And plus the fact that I did a lot of work since 1982 in casino towns like Las Vegas and Reno, Atlantic City, Tahoe, where you have to register as a known felon, as a narcotics felon, with the police upon arrival within 24 hours and give precious bodily fluids to them so they can analyze them. So I was very heavily monitored.
Now that you're not going to be monitored anymore because you're off probation, are you, you know, pretty certain you've got the strength of will to not go back on drugs?
Well, I certainly hope so, you know, but it's something you have to always keep your guard up against because of that psychological addiction, which takes so long to overcome, and the flashbacks that occasionally occur to anyone who's, you know, been exposed to drugs for as long a period as I was.
Have you had any desire to, like, renounce your past or...
No, I wish I could change some of it. Mm-hmm. Mostly changing my lack of being a proper role model for my children, you know.
Right.
I mean, it's really the most painful thing, not really being there during the tender years, you know, to take care of them. I'm very lucky to have had a, you know, have a second chance now to do it. That I have a 6-year-old kid named Bijou, who's great, and a 15-year-old boy named Tam, and it's really a privilege, you know, to be able to give them what I wasn't able to give the other children.
So what are you doing now musically?
Well, I'm touring with the Mamas and Papas. I intend on sort of re-entering into the music industry now that I'm off probation. I didn't want to really be out there doing that kind of thing while, you know, while I was on probation, because it was just too much risk to other people for me to be around and things like that. You know, it's a long story about that. But now that I feel, you know, strong enough to go back in and regulate my life properly and still do the music, and I'm touring with the Mamas and Papas, and we're playing everywhere, and we're getting lots of offers to record as the Mamas and Papas, which we're turning down because we don't want to call ourselves the Mamas and Papas on record.
Mm-hmm.
We'd like to call it like Cats and Mice or something, or Cheese, or whatever. It doesn't make any difference, really. But we don't want to play around with what the original Mamas and Papas did, because you can't really replace Cass and you can't replace Michelle. And Spanky and Mackenzie aren't trying to replace them. You know, I mean, they're stars in their own right, and that's the way it should be.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I appreciate it.
My guest has been John Phillips, the founder of the Mamas and Papas. He's written an autobiography titled Papa John, published by Doubleday. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Joyce Lieberman and Orji Voblaitis. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Sallet is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I are the producers of the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview or for a listing of other programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4892. That number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible in part with funds provided by Philadelphia-based Cigna Corporation, a provider of insurance and related financial services to businesses and individuals worldwide. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.